Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today, I'm talking with the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, Ajit Pai, who has just announced plans to roll back net neutrality rules that went into effect in late 2014 during the Obama administration. The FCC will vote on the proposal in mid-December when it is expected to pass. Ajit Pai, welcome to The Reason Podcast.
Great to be with you, Nick.
Okay, so let's get right to it. The big fear that many net neutrality proponents have is that once you let internet service providers and wireless carriers do whatever they want, the internet is going to turn into something worse than cable TV, with some content being pushed over others because the parent company owns it, you know, Comcast and Universal, that type of thing. Other content is going to be choked off because they're not paying enough to, you know, to get best service right to the end, or it's just going to be completely blocked. Why is that wrong?
It's wrong for two different reasons. First, it's not the experience we had before these regulations were imposed in 2015. We were not living in some digital dystopia before then when ISPs were blocking lawful content. Secondly, we require under this proposal to require the ISPs to be transparent about their business practices. If they're blocking or throttling or doing any of that, they have to disclose it. And secondly, we empower the Federal Trade Commission to take aggressive action based on its consumer protection and competition authorities to take action against cases like that. If it's a network operator preferencing its own content, that's something the FTC can look at. If it's
content. Would that be legal, though, under these rules? And should it be legal?
No, so exactly. We're requiring it to be transparent. And then additionally, to the extent that a company is unlawfully throttling traffic, the FTC can look into that. In fact, the last couple of years, the FTC has done that with respect to a few wireless carriers that were allegedly throttling traffic. They said, this is not a lawful practice. We're going to sanction you for it.
Why is it not? But would it be an unlawful practice if you get rid of net neutrality? Because there might be, you know, or if a carrier says, you know what, yeah, we are going to throttle traffic because we want to privilege certain other services. Would that be lawful as long as it's transparent?
Again, they have to disclose it. And secondly, to the extent that they're doing something anti-competitive, and it was very fact-dependent, of course, but the FTC has a long-standing set of principles that it uses to evaluate conduct like that. And so it could well be anti-competitive. It just depends on the facts.
Okay. Or it could be that they're abrogating their own self-declared terms of service. So they say, hey, we're not going to throttle anything. You find out they're throttling or privileging content, then they're in trouble because of their own promises.
Correct, but there are some ways that it could be pro-competitive. For example, if they say, you know, we'll allow you to stream all of these services exempt from your data limits, then that's the kind of thing that would be good for consumers. And so we don't want to prohibit different pro-competitive offerings like that.
And to get to that point, that's already happening under net neutrality, isn't it? Where certain, particularly wireless carriers, privilege, you can stream on T-Mobile or something, you know, a particular set of Netflix or music services that are not subject to your monthly cap.
That is what a lot of the companies have proposed, such as T-Mobile, and it's telling that the first investigations that the prior FCC initiated under these so-called net neutrality rules were involving free data offerings. And to me, it's just absurd to say that the government should stand in the way of consumers who want to get and companies that want to provide free data. That's the kind of thing that is good for the marketplace, and I don't think we should prevent that kind of service.
Where is the competition in internet services? Another major complaint, and these are things that, you know, make a lot of sense on face value, of, you know, most people don't really have two equally good options, much less three or four options to pick and choose from when it comes to an ISP. You know, you're stuck with whatever cable company got the monopoly 30 or even 40 years ago when local municipalities handed this stuff out. Is that wrong? Or where will, you know, a lot of what you're talking about is that markets, which are based on competition, drive innovation, and they bring, you know, this is Joseph Schumpeter 101, they bring more and better services increasingly at cheaper and cheaper prices. But where's the competition in internet services?
So two different points. Number one, it does depend upon the marketplace. For example, in wireless, there's very intense competition. You have four national carriers and any number of regional carriers competing to provide 4G LTE and a number of different services. Now, in those marketplaces where there is not as much competition as we'd like to see, to me at least, the solution isn't to preemptively regulate as if it were a monopoly, as if we're dealing with Ma Bell, but it's to promote more competition. Ironically enough, these Title II regulations squeeze the smaller companies, the smaller internet service providers that want to enter the marketplace and gain a foothold against the big guys. And they have told us, a number of them, once you see the order, you'll see that they have written us and saying, it's very difficult for us to raise capital. It's almost impossible for us to get a rate of return on our investment if these regulations are in place. And ironically enough, these heavy-handed regulations disproportionately hurt the smaller companies. You know, the big incumbents will always have fleets of lawyers and accountants to deal with these regulations. It's the smaller companies, and I've visited some of them, even government-owned ISPs in Iowa, for instance, that have told me that this hurts their ability to build a business.
So in a Wall Street Journal piece that ran today, you talked about how the Wireless Internet Service Providers Association, which represents small fixed ISPs, essentially, or wireless companies, rather, that generally operate in rural America, 80% of their members say they incurred additional expenses in complying with the Title II or the net neutrality rules. They had delayed or reduced network expansion, delayed or reduced services, and had, because the rules cost money to comply with. You also pointed out, and you touched on this, 19 municipal Wi-Fi services and one major company stopped rolling out an out-of-home Wi-Fi service. So net neutrality rules have had a cost. What was the major company that said that it wouldn't roll an out-of-home Wi-Fi service?
That was Charter.
Okay.
That goes by spectrum in a number of markets.
Right. And then the other thing that you talked about was that in the Wall Street Journal piece, in the 2 years after the FCC's decision, after the 2015 decision, in the years after that broadband network dropped by almost 6%, the first time a decline has happened outside of a recession. What does that mean?
So historically, since the dawn of the commercial internet, ISPs have been investing as much as they can into networks in order to upgrade their facilities and to compete with each other. What we saw, and so outside of a recession, we've never seen that kind of investment go down year over year. But we did after 2015, once these regulations were adopted. And one of the things that our economic analysis finds in the order is that these Title II regulations lowered the willingness of companies to invest. And that unfortunately has a very bad impact on consumers who are on the wrong side of what I call the digital divide, rural consumers, low-income urban consumers. These are the folks for whom it's very difficult as it is for a private company to build a business case for deploying infrastructure to them. They are going to be on the front lines if these heavy-handed regulations persist. And that's part of the reason why I proposed repealing them.
What facts or developments, say, over the next 2 years or the next 5 years, next 10 years down the road would convince you that the repeal of net neutrality was a bad mistake or a failure? You know, be specific. What are the benchmarks that we can hold you or the FCC to in the coming years?
Absolutely. My top line message when it comes to regulation is that the FCC should preemptively regulate only in cases where we have a market failure. And so if in the context of the internet, we did see a market failure, we saw ISPs all over of all sizes behaving in uncompetitive ways, if we saw consumers being harmed, those are the kinds of things that we would want to take account of. And we certainly don't want to see that. And my prediction is that these rules will actually take us in the opposite direction from that. They'll promote more investment and competition.
So I mean, one benchmark would be is if we see persistent lower capital investment year over year, that would be a sign that and it might not be because of the repeal of net neutrality, but that's a bad sign. Would it also be things like the slower speed of average connections, cost of plans, number of fixed and mobile connections, either flatlining or going down? Are those the other types of things that we should look for?
Yeah, those are some of the indicia that we would take into account, similarly to make sure that we don't see widespread blocking of lawful content. I mean, that's not something I think anybody wants to see. And that's not the internet we've had, and I don't expect that's the internet we will have.
Well, that is, and I'm thinking of, I'm hearing, you know, defenders of net neutrality whispering in my ear as I say this. I mean, there's the idea that before the, and I guess the first time when net neutrality was kind of pushed by the FCC was in 2010, but then it was various court challenges, et cetera. In 2015, it becomes a reality where the internet is being regulated under Title II, these old telecommunications rules from the 30s. What is, you know, can we rely on the experience of the internet from the, I guess, you know, really from the early 90s or from the Telecommunications Act of 1996 until 2015? Is that the internet that we'll go back to?
I believe so. I think we will have a free and open internet as we had before 2015. And moreover, I think we're going to see it become even better going forward. And the reason is that with technological innovation, we're entering on the wireless side, for example, a new era of technology known as 5G. And that's going to require massive amounts of investment in networks and in spectrum. And that's the kind of thing that I think will be a big breakthrough for consumers on the wireless side.
Do you think, I mean, are we entering an era, this is, you know, one of the criticisms of net neutrality is that, you know, it was essentially partly pushed by industries or companies that had have a vested interest in things the way they are now. And that includes Netflix, it includes Google, it includes to a certain degree Amazon, you know, that they wanted to stop the internet development as it is now and that they were all about kind of fixed connections. Are we going to be, do you think it's likely that we're going to be entering an era of wireless where most things are based on wireless connectivity?
I think so. There is one particularly insightful person up in Silicon Valley who talked about how, as he puts it, mobile is eating the world, how all of these services are migrating to wireless, and how, particularly in the future, whether we are talking about low bandwidth applications like wirelessly monitoring yogurt trucks as they drive across the countryside, or high bandwidth applications like virtual reality, a lot of this is going to be taking place over wireless. And
mobile stuff. I'm sorry, you know, I'm sorry, I confused the terminology, but yeah, that the idea.
Oh, no, mobile is absolutely right.
And that we're going to be, you know, we're already, and I can actually see this at Reason's traffic, you know, more and more it's mobile devices as opposed to people looking at their computer, you know, at work or at home. What else has to happen for 5G? Are there other regulatory changes that have to happen for mobile wireless to go gigantic?
A lot of them. So number one, the FCC needs to make more spectrum available. It doesn't help if you have a bottleneck in terms of spectrum. And so we're aggressively moving to get as much as we can out into the commercial marketplace, both for licensed, the cell carriers and the like, but also unlicensed, the next generation of Wi-Fi. The second thing is we also need to make it easier to deploy a lot of the infrastructure. The future of wireless networks are not going to be ones where you'll see a bunch of 100-foot cell towers. Instead, you'll see hundreds, if not thousands, of small cells, some of which you could even hold in your hand. You won't even notice them on the sides of buildings and the like. But to deploy those, we need to make sure that we don't impose the same onerous regulations that we do for a big cell tower. And you know, they shouldn't have to go through environmental and historic preservation review, for instance. And we don't want to have states and localities also imposing moratoria on these kinds of siting applications.
Those
are some of the things that have to happen.
Yeah, and that was common early on, you know, going back 20, 30, 40 years when cell phones were really becoming popular. A lot of places put limits on where cell towers could be located or how many. When you say you don't want them to have to go through, you know, historic review committees in small towns and stuff like that, is that based on the fact that these will be unobtrusive, or what is the rationale for that?
So part of it is that they will be unobtrusive in a lot of cases. And part of it is also that we don't want to have a patchwork where it's not just the federal government, but 50 state governments, any number of municipalities, and 567 federally recognized tribes each are trying to have a bite at the regulatory apple, so to speak. If we really want to claim leadership in the 5G future and compete against countries like China and Korea and Japan, which have a much more, they are very eager to take the lead on 5G, then we need to make sure that our regulatory framework is streamlined, you know, preserves the public interest, but also incentivizes investment. And that's not, I don't think, where we are right now.
So I see this as the next battleground in fair weather federalism, because it sounds like, you know, so you're going to have a Republican Congress, I assume, or rulemaking apparatus that is saying, no, the federal government really should control all of this. And then you'll have Democrats who are normally averse to states' rights saying, no, no, it's got to be devolved down. Do you think that's right. a likely, you know, development?
That could always happen, but to me at least, the internet is inherently, at this point, broadband internet is inherently an interstate service, and interstate service is traditionally the touchstone for federal regulation. And so but my hope is that we can put the politics aside and focus on exactly how these networks operate. And if we do that, then I think there's a strong case for federal government leadership here.
Your plan will, according to a write-up in Politico, and I think this is accurate, it will jettison rules that prohibit internet service providers from blocking or slowing web traffic or creating so-called paid internet fast lanes. Question for you. Do you think fast lanes will become a thing? And what is the value of an internet fast lane?
The answer to the first is we're not sure. We've never seen them before, and that's part of the reason why I thought the rule in particular was that was adopted in 2015 was very premature, banning something that simply didn't exist. But secondly, going forward, I mean, we could see pro-competitive and anti-competitive cases for those kinds of prioritization arrangements. For example, if you want to prioritize traffic in your healthcare provider that needs to monitor patients remotely, I mean, that's the kind of traffic that should take precedence, you might think, over cat videos and the like. Conversely, we don't want to see cases in which companies are behaving anti-competitively and structuring those kinds of prioritization arrangements. And so you can make a case either way, and I think that's part of the reason why the Federal Trade Commission is the right agency to handle that, because that's essentially an antitrust question, and that's something that they have long experience in taking care of.
Mentioning the FTC, though, isn't it also much more limited than the FCC was under Title II? I mean, it really doesn't have the same scope of authority to regulate. I can't do as much, can it?
To the contrary, actually, it can do even more in a lot of cases. For example, they can take action even in the absence of a finding of harm, a consumer harm. So even if consumers aren't harmed, if they deem a particular business practice, any business practice, to be unfair or deceptive, they have authority under Section 5 to take action against it. And so that's a pretty powerful tool that they've used even in the last couple of years against telecom providers and others in the internet economy who they believe are not protecting consumers.
So are you the first kind of commission head to actually say, no, I want less power?
Well, you know, I have talked to some of my predecessors going all the way back to the Reagan years, and this is one of the constant battles that you see over the years, is that in any administration, whether it's a Republican administration where they're taking a free market position and they're attacked for that, or a Democratic administration where they take a more regulatory view, this is a constant back and forth. And so I see myself as the next in line in this long tradition, not a break from that tradition.
What do you make of the fact that, you know, part of this is due to John Oliver, who, called his army of internet trolls to, you know, bombard the FCC website with comments during the comment period about the proposed rollback. And that's good things. I mean, it's kind of amazing that we've had, you know, tens of millions of people, you know, who are suddenly motivated to talk about the, you know, arcane subject of telecommunications policy. But there was something, there were over 20 million comments against ending net neutrality from one count I read. How do you process that kind of pushback against what you're proposing?
So there was a mix of opinion in the comments, and we had to take a look at all of the comments in the record that were substantive and significant and that were contributing to helping to answer some of the questions that we teed up in our notice of proposed rulemaking. It wasn't easy, but when you see the order, you'll find that we did try to sort through as many as we possibly could and incorporated as many as we possibly could into our decision making.
Let me switch topics slightly. I want to ask you about a different area that has to do with free speech and free expression and kind of the free internet. Currently in the Senate, there is a bill going through called the Stop Enabling Sexual Traffickers Act, or SESTA. There's a version of it in the House as well. In the name of cracking down on human trafficking, the legislation would, in the words of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which, you know, is in favor of net neutrality, but they're against this. They say that SESTA would eviscerate the immunity from liability for user-generated comment that internet intermediaries have under Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, and would also amend the federal criminal sex trafficking statute to sweep in companies who may not even be aware of what their users are doing. Now, Section 230 is one of those defining laws of the internet where it created a safe harbor for internet service providers and sites from content posted by users and whatnot. It's widely credited with helping the internet and the World Wide Web, especially the web, become what we know it as. Are you worried that 230 is being undermined by SESTA and that 230 is absolutely essential to a flourishing internet?
So here, I unfortunately have to give the unsatisfactory answer that I haven't read the legislation itself. I've read press accounts, obviously, about the debate and been following it from afar as it's gone through the relevant committees. So I haven't had a chance to study it and think through what the implications would be. I know there were some fixes, for instance, that were adopted late in the process before it went out of the committee, and I haven't had a chance to think whether those ameliorate the concerns that you're talking about. And so at this point, I've been so focused on what we're doing over here at the FCC that I haven't had a chance to think about it.
But more broadly, though, do you think that the safe harbor, you know, that's provided in general by 230 is a good and very important thing?
I do remember when I was in law school in the mid-90s, there was a significant debate about this, and we were debating at the time, I'm really dating myself now, but should this be equivalent to, you know, should bulletin board owners be liable for what their users post? And it seems quaint now, but it's amazing how vibrant this debate still is, because I think there is a sense that online platform thrives precisely because the owner of that platform, you know, isn't liable necessarily for everything that is posted on there. So I can see the argument both ways. And obviously, this is an important issue in terms of sex trafficking that a lot of elected officials have their eyes on. And so hopefully there's a way to thread the needle that satisfies everybody's concerns.
So speaking like a Michigan alum, which you are, correct? Yes, Ed, you are tackling yourself, aren't you? You're not going to answer that question definitively. I get that.
Well, no, I'm just not a Michigan alum, so I didn't want to offend all the big blue fans out there.
I'm sorry. You're a Michigan resident then, or you grew up in Michigan?
No, grew up in Kansas. University of Chicago. So
I apologize for besmirching you with any connection to Michigan other than having flown through it on a couple of occasions.
Well, I was especially nervous because my in-laws are all Ohio State fans, so Thanksgiving would be a little difficult if they suddenly suspected some kind of Harbaugh connection.
I can absolutely understand that. So, going forward, what are you looking for on the near horizon besides 5G that most excites you about about the internet and about telecommunications more broadly?
To me, at least, it's our efforts to close the digital divide. And I understand that things like net neutrality will occupy 99% of the oxygen in the room. But to me, at least, that percentage is more properly devoted to what we're doing to build out access to people on the wrong side of that divide who don't have access to the internet today, and to promote more competition using innovative technologies. We've talked about 5G, but this FCC over the last 10 months has already approved the first ever satellite applications, sending satellites into low Earth orbit and beaming very high-speed connectivity back to Earth. We're getting more spectrum out there for fixed wireless providers to use so they can compete without having to lay fiber. And for the smaller fiber providers, we've taken a number of steps, both in terms of wiser distribution of our federal subsidies and our regulatory reform to give them a fighting chance. Whether it's in inner city Detroit or in rural Kansas, they are going to have a chance to compete. And so my hope is that over the next coming years, we're going to see an explosion in the kinds of connectivity and the depth of that connectivity. And ultimately, that means that the human capital in the United States that's currently on the shelf, that the people who don't have digital opportunity will be able to be spectator or participants in the digital economy instead of just spectators.
Where do you get that new spectrum space from? Are you taking it back from broadcast, or are you freeing up stuff that's just been collecting dust or squeezing out more efficiency?
It's a little bit of a mix. So squeezing out efficiency is the name of the game in some cases where you have, for example, federal agencies using the spectrum, and we're trying to see if there are creative ways for us to share that spectrum. Additionally, there is some spectrum that's been fallow for a while, and because of technological innovation, we're able to now use it potentially for wireless service. And there's also some spectrum that has been owned by incumbents that we've sold and then given a share of the proceeds to those incumbents and then transferred it to other companies that want the spectrum. So it's sort of an all-hands-on deck approach when it comes to the airways.
You were appointed chairman by President Donald Trump. You were on the commission before that as a Republican appointee. Do you feel that you're part of what former Trump advisor Steve Bannon said was an attempt to deconstruct the administrative state? Can you make a positive case for being a regulator, essentially a bureaucrat who is saying you should be seeing less and less of me as time goes on?
I mean, to me at least, having worked in this agency for the better part of the past decade, it was very clear to me when I came into office that there were a lot of rules on the books that simply weren't appropriate for 2017. In some cases, they were holding back investment and innovation. In other cases, they were on the books simply as a matter of regulatory inertia. And so we had a chance to think very broadly about how do we want to promote more competition and investment across all of these industries, from broadband to media. And over the last 10 months, we've had the chance to do that. And I think over time, the folks are going to see the results speak for themselves, that we do want the regulations to be more market-based and light touch, to reflect the law as Congress gave it to us, not whatever policy vision we might dream up for ourselves. And I think that's not just a free market deregulatory view, but it's a view that's, I think, appropriate for the marketplace and for consumers in 2017.
Final question. In your Wall Street Journal piece and elsewhere, and it's not just you, but people were very upset. Regulators were upset, as well as, I was upset when Barack Obama really hammered the then chair of the FCC to pass net neutrality. It was, it's not quite unprecedented and it's not quite wrong, but he really got on a soapbox and said, you guys really have to do this and you have to get it done. And it seemed to have a direct effect. I mean, there's no question that Obama really squeezed what's supposed to be an independent commission. Would you push back if Donald Trump suddenly came to you and said, I really need you to put net neutrality back, or I want you to do something that you think would undermine the integrity of the of market-based approaches and rule of law approaches to telecommunications policy?
Well, look, I've said from day one, since I became chair, that this is an independent agency, that we will make our own decisions based on the facts as we find them and the law as we see it, and we'll call the shots accordingly. And we're not going to let any political considerations from any quarter dictate or pressure us into making a decision that we truly believe is not in the public interest. And I don't know about my other fellow commissioners, but speaking for myself, that's the one thing I think that gives our decisions credence in the eyes of the American people, is that we're seen as the experts on communications issues, not as political actors that sway with the wind, depending on who's weighing in.
Well, I certainly look forward to seeing what happens over the not just the next couple of weeks, but the next couple of years. Thank you so much, Chairman Ajit Pai of the Federal Communications Commission, for talking to the Reason Podcast.
Thank you, sir.
This has been the Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there.